So last time you mentioned, or maybe I'll just sort of say like a kind of a characteristic part of Ajahn Chah's style is for when chores need to be done by a community, like the encouragement is for everyone to come and help out and stay until the job is finished.
Yeah.
And then everybody disperses appropriately. Can you talk about like maybe why that is, or how what that adds to the community?
Well, I think one of the things that it adds to the community is that it's a communal chore. Everybody benefits from the chore. So then having everybody pitch in, you know, is it one? It's a how do you say there's kind of like out of respect for the community. Then one pitches in and helps, and then the community. One, it gets things done, and because oftentimes if you know there's chores, and then some people show up, some people don't show up, some people don't show up consistently. There's festering kind of resentments, and it'll display itself in disharmony. So that's it's an important way of trying to maintain communal harmony, and really trying to put that emphasis on communal harmony, because it's just normal that if you're busting your ass doing something, and then a couple people are just consistently hanging around somewhere else, drinking tea and schmoozing, it's not for increase of wholesome states and decrease of unwholesome states. It helps to create that communal harmony. It also, if everybody pitches in, it really doesn't take that long to get it done and go back to your good tea or whatever. So those are some of the kind of advantages or benefits, and it's ordinary that on some days you don't feel like doing the chores, or you don't feel like doing a particular task, you have to learn how to not to believe your moods all the time. So that, I mean, there is a bigger point in the practice as well, in the sense of, because if we spend our whole life following our moods, hoping that we'll come to a complete cessation of suffering by getting what I want when I want it, and not have to deal with the things that I don't want and don't like, tough luck. It ain't going to happen. And so that learning how to push through the kind of moods and dislikes or likes that we have that are, it's ordinary. But it's the ordinary tendency that keeps us tethered to a cycle of suffering. It isn't that will, if we just learn how to meditate, get the jhanas and contemplate anicca dukkha anatta all the time, then we'll be free of suffering. There's a lot more to it than that. And much of it comes in very ordinary circumstances where these deep-seated habit patterns, deep-seated views, deep-seated clinging to a sense of me, a sense of self. That's something I remember reading years and years ago. And I don't even remember what book it's in. I remember writing it down, though. And an American conception of freedom is the freedom to not have to do what you don't want and the freedom to choose what you like. And that's freedom. Well, Buddha's got a very different concept of freedom. The sort of freedom from the greed, hatred, and illusion, freedom from the tendency to attachment and clinging.
What you speak about right now, I've seen in my own practice, like other parts of the communal dynamics working in that same, like as it's functionally the same, like pujas, you know, especially for me, morning puja,
yeah.
You know, that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's just a sort of like, and there's a freedom that comes when we know that we can, does not mean we have to do it all the time, or that we don't, but it's sort of not being bound by, having to fit into everything that we want or decide is comfortable for us. And so it's and that's a tricky part of having a practice situation as a monastery and as a community, and because you don't want to be running a monastery so that it's going against every single area that people find uncomfortable. That becomes oppressive. There are elements of just having things set up. So, yeah, we have to actually learn how to not be, we can put forth effort and maintain mindfulness in situations that we're not used to. Because a lot of it's around basic kind of drives, food, sleep, sense restraint in different ways. So we start learning about deeply rooted habits of mind.
So then presumably that, like, will translate into, or that will help us in solitude? Is that part of it?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. When the... I found that oftentimes when people have learned how to work within the community well, when they go into solitude, there tends to be a lot of positive mental states arising, a lot of ease in disciplining themselves, a lot more self-discipline, ability to maintain practice in a way that is really quite balanced. And I've just seen that over and over and over again. The skills that we learn about ourselves and our habits and our ability to create structures for ourselves to practice, it's the transition to being on one's own and practicing is that's directly translatable, and so it is something that there really is a great benefit there.
And where, besides, obviously, Kusala Dhamma's up, Akusala Dhamma's down, Matt, like, how do we find balance, or what? How do we know when we're ready, or, you know, just in general, maybe balancing the solitude and the communal aspects of the practice?
I think it just is. It relies on experimenting and also realizing that different times there's different pulls and in terms of being drawn in a wholesome way in one way or the other, and you know, and as the way the mind works, and you know, it gets bored or gets a bit stale, and you have to change it up somehow. That's an ongoing, you know, a skill that we have to learn of how to adjust our practice so that we're supporting us, as opposed to having a kind of ideal of you know, whether it's the ideal of, you know, of full on engagement with community practice or complete solitude. I mean, those are ideals, and oftentimes it's just learning how to adjust it and learn from the situations, and then give oneself an opportunity. And there, like I really enjoy, as much as I've lived in community, I really enjoy solitude and solitary practice. Almost invariably, when I do have a chance to go have extended solitude, then I'm just a bit more would be good.
Some of the deep-seated patterns may be more visible to other people than ourselves. So
that's another aspect of living in community is it makes complete logical sense to us why that particular person is an idiot or that. response of aversion or whatever, you know, all the different ways that we do respond out of our assumptions in our mind, and so it's, we built that up over time, we've invested in it, and we reap the karmic fruits of that.
I guess I've always been a bit curious as to, I know it's better for us to discover them ourselves, but is there ever a place for some pointing out in some sensitive way?
Sometimes. But I think it is. The thing is also you have to trust people that they are sincere in the practice. And that there, because if you're telling everybody all their faults and their flaws and their deep seated habits, that might be a deep seated habit. And you know, and people. We really learn something, and we're willing to change when we see it ourselves, and that's something that Ajahn Chah was really skillful at being able to hold up a mirror in ways, or set up conditions in ways that we would we'd be able to see that, and also the it'd be rare that he would actually point to a person and point out a particular flaw or fault or something, but so often it comes out in Dhamma talks and we're just describing a particular habit or way that people create suffering, and it's sort of, you know, generic people. But you realize, oh, he's actually, well, it's me. and then we can pick that up, and it's less challenging, and when we are willing to learn and willing to change, then that's when we really that change actually does take place.
So I was thinking to explore maybe that the kind of the sense of mentorship and admonishment a little bit more, like, mm-hmm. It's interesting, like in both the suttas, it's the path of practices or living in communities, like mutual admonishment, mutual rehabilitation, and also thinking back to like the Vinaya and Upatthaking, part of the duties, if I recall correctly, is that of the junior member is that if he sees his senior acting in unskillful ways, to use skillful means to try to let him know, or so. I mean, I can especially see like in maybe a more traditional Asian context that can be really, it takes a lot of skill to be able to do that. Yeah. And so, but I mean, obviously we are all, you know, in this community, we all point things out to each other to one degree or the other. Can you talk about what the what's important when pointing things out or admonishing people?
Well, I mean, one is being really sensitive to the situation, because if you point out something to somebody that is troublesome, or that if it comes from a really, you're just sort of totally frustrated and fed up, and then you blurt it out, it usually doesn't land very well, even if it's true. But it just doesn't land very well. And so it's not very useful on either side. So that being willing to wait for a proper occasion, and also wait for a proper time, that internally one feels one's not just speaking out of kilesa, one's own kilesa. And Rajanamaro telling a story about, this is the old days of like Chithurst. How many years was it that a monk waited to? Was it him? Was that Ajahn Amaro?
He waited like more than a year to point something out to,
yeah.
I think, Lumparsameo, was my memory was right.
Yeah. So it's just where it was sort of either the upset or the kind of feeling of emotion around it settled. So that's a really great example. Because also, especially in Sangha, generally, we're not going anywhere. So you have to really be willing to take it on for one's own transformation, as well as that goodwill towards somebody else. And there's the classic say, guidance that Ajahn Chah gives don't admonish somebody before the meal. It's after Pindabhat, before the meal. People are hungry. It's not the best time. It's just very practical. So the time and place is really important. And one's own intention and mood at the time is very important. So it goes both ways. And that wish to, because especially thinking in terms of the individual's welfare and happiness and the community's welfare and happiness. So it's really important to be casting it in that light rather than. And just acting on an impulsive aversion that is based on one's own kind of preference of how you'd like that person to be, and that or one's view and opinion how they should be, and that usually ends up messy. That really training oneself in thinking the Buddha does set that up in the Vinaya very clearly, that the duty of the senior to junior to senior, they're mutual. They're in the Vinaya, it's basically the exact same phrasing. But the idea is to be trying to encourage people in the holy life for their opportunity to free themselves from suffering.
And also another question along the same lines would be around the spectrum of maybe really refined kolwat, through some of the offenses, the smaller offenses, and then the heavier stuff, is there different, a different way of deciding depending upon the severity of the...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if somebody is transgressing Sangati Sesa blatantly, then you don't wait for the right time so he feels okay and I feel okay. And something has to be done, and that's a protecting the sasana, protecting the training, protecting the sangha as a refuge, and so that refuge for the resident community, or refuge for the greater lay community, so that one is trying to uphold appropriate standards for a samana, for a religious seeker, and that has to be acted on quite quickly. Whereas other things that are more refined aspects of etiquette, and then you sort of slowly work on those.
Along the same question, the ones that I find often more stuck on are the ones in the middle, things that are the chidya kind of rough behavior, and, mm-hmm. It's not something to say, but it's sort of like, at the same time, it's not
in line with living a holy life.
But it's like it's also not that extreme either. So I'm often stuck with whether or not to say something. Called senior, I'm not really sure.
Yes, I mean sometimes it's better to point it out to the senior monks or let the senior monks deal with it. And then they are, and then they can gauge appropriate timing or way of addressing it, and so that's a way to work around that, and oftentimes it depends on the situation, the person, if it's kind of course behavior that really doesn't fit into the ethos of either of the monk's training or the community itself, then that's oftentimes something that is uncomfortable to address with somebody. It's helpful to have, especially when you're fairly even in peer relationship. So then it's helpful to request let the senior monks know, and then let them deal with it, because the senior monks don't see everything. Everybody's very well behaved in front of me.
It's sort of I've heard it said that like Lungpa Chas, somebody asked him about like psychic powers, whether or not he could read his students' minds, and he said something like, "I don't need to. I just see how they walk in the door, how they bow." Is that something that like it probably happens over time when you see so many monks and so many mental states, you start to get a sense for that?
You get a feel for that, yeah. Certainly not on the level that Ajahn Chah did. He was very astute, really good reader of character. Over time, and you see how people, their personality and mental states are expressed through the body so much, and how people hold themselves, how they do things, how they move, how they don't move. So being able to tune in to that, and just over time one gains a certain sensitivity.
So sometimes people are in a state of suffering,
yeah.
And it's like you might want to ease that for them, maybe not fix them necessarily, but like help them out,
mm-hmm.
be a comforting presence for them,
yeah.
In some sort of way. And are there times when it's appropriate to let someone not, or to not be that comforting presence, to like kind of?
Well, it depends. I mean, in the sense of, you have to qualify that, because sometimes sometimes you have to be willing to let people suffer and not be, because oftentimes what happens when you see somebody suffering, it's sort of like you want to help, but then we suffer because we don't want to see them suffering, and so that's an aspect of that's our own suffering that we're taking on, and sort of, will you stop suffering so I don't have to suffer? That's kind of selfish. and then sometimes just being, and it depends if it's over and over and over again, then sometimes people feed off of that attention, and it's not helpful. to them, to try to help them, or try to support them, try to, and because it's sort of, it's fulfilling their need to get attention and be acknowledged, and it's a kind of it's not a very functional way of living. So that sometimes it's important just to let them be, so that they can figure it out how to free themselves. But there isn't a sort of hard and fast response to that we can give, or that I can give on that. But it's really over time you have a sense of different people or different situations, you respond in different ways. It sometimes it's the most compassionate thing to do is let somebody suffer. It isn't as if it's coming from neglect or aversion. It's sort of like, gosh, or where one really sees everything hasn't worked. How do I? Let's watch this a bit more closely.
Or with recurrent, sort of deep-seated ruts of suffering in monks, have you ever seen the need to recommend them to sort of alternate modern therapies or medication, or have you sort of been able to completely trust the training and just, if as long as they're kind of willing to stick with it, that seems to actually really cure it? Or have you ever seen it necessary to kind of send them to a psychotherapist? Or
The thing is, absolutely, because sometimes because we're not trained psychotherapists, we're not trained, and there are certain habit patterns that are really deep rooted that some people aren't able to use the practice, use the Dhamma to help themselves with. It isn't as if meditation and Buddhism is a panacea for all suffering. I don't believe that at all. But there, I can remember being quite idealistic and then having to deal with people who were like truly psychotic, you really get an appreciation for Halidol. We were having people flip out at one night and chat, just pretty regularly.
Those are pretty extreme examples, but for more sort of moderate American neurosis.
Just your ordinary screwed up. Just your ordinary screwed up person.
Yeah. Do you think the Dharma will do? And also, do I need a psychotherapist? I trust your judgment.
I think you'd be okay. I think for ordinary, and oftentimes it takes time. But there are deep rooted things that I think it's helpful to have a professional. Having said that, you actually have to find somebody who has a psychotherapeutic practice that has an appreciation for Buddhist principles and how to implement the two or to balance the two. So it's something that is not, there are plenty of people in the psychotherapeutic world who just don't really have an appreciation for the structures of the of sila or meditation or an actual training. So it's important that trying to find somebody who is, and when it has happened, then generally I've had to. It's not that easy to find somebody who actually I would trust. Sometimes a lot of the motivation for people going into psychiatry or psychotherapy as therapists and their own screwed up backgrounds. Sometimes they'll read things in. I don't know that's true. And I think it's okay out in the world. But this is somebody who has the motivation to be in a sangha environment has already got a good foundation, but there's a way forward, but it does need some tweaking.
I have a friend who's about to retire as a psychotherapist, very intelligent, I think, very well respected, and I talked to her a little bit about it, and she's becoming more spiritual, I think, as she grows older, and she said, just stick with the spiritual life, is what she told me.
Yeah.
But I have to be honest, I have a lay teacher who I respect very much, and he starts seeing a therapist, an elder lay teacher, and I didn't know, I was a little confused about it, I've learned so much about him, but I try to be open and supportive, or whatever, it has nothing to do with me anyways, but still, the honest thought in me was, wow, if Buddhism isn't working for you, what am I going to do? And he was a monk for many years as well and all this, but I hear what you're saying.
Somebody who is skilled is because sometimes it's like I remember my very first time coming back to North America, and then while I was mostly for visiting family, but I had an invitation to go to Chicago and teach. There was a Thai monk there who I knew, and he had a daily meditation going at his monastery that the lay people from around would come. One of the women who came was, I ended up talking with her for quite a lot. She was really very intelligent, very sincere practitioner. And she was a psychiatrist who specialized in treating other psychiatrists. And she said, without this Dhamma practice, I wouldn't be able to be effective. It'd be overwhelming. It's because it's like the psychiatrists know the theory and know the jargon, and they're able to move. And on a certain level, sometimes Dhamma teachers can have they know the, you know the words, you know the teachings, you know the ideas, and you're able to sidestep around, because that's what defilements want to do. They want to sidestep. They want to delude. So it's that's where it's helpful to have mirrors.
Yeah, I think also there's a, I've just seen a friend who's done 7 years of high school counselling, you know, and she's heard some pretty rough stuff that, you know, you kind of need some support sometimes with just, you know, how that's affecting you, Martha.
Yeah, that's a whole other element to it, yeah. Just having the tools to absorb and let go, because we're affected by the impingements that we have.
Just thinking about also like the monastic form and. Like, I don't know, maybe the benefits or the differences is like we live day in, day out with this generally the same people. And so I'm just thinking about how that like stability of the environment helps maybe, you know, like this whole spiritual bypassing kind of type thing you're talking about.
Yes. And it's when you live in such close quarters with people day in, day out, and if you try to pull too much kind of bullshit, you'll get called on it. Which is really good. And it helps to sort of see for oneself or do or to, you know, be painfully made aware of it.
I think also too, when one goes and stays in different monasteries and sees the same stuff manifesting over and over,
that stuff, it's a little bit harder to, it's just, you know, it's not me. Valuable to the gratitude.
Yes. Okay, we'll have a break.
Well, did you have something? Just one, hopefully short, yeah. Sort of bringing it, just reflecting on that, like back to what we were talking about before with communal and solitary practice, just like this Abhayagiri's specific kind of daily and yearly schedule seems to be quite balanced well, and I was just curious about how you and Ajahn Amaro, like, how did that happen? Did you guys plan it from the beginning, or did you have to experiment?
Well, we both have lived in different monasteries and had different experiences. I spent all my time in Thailand. He spent all his time in England, and there were certainly elements of training that we both wanted to implement, given that we had a blank canvas, and this is the direction we definitely wanted to go in, and so you know, it took some tweaking along the way and some experimenting, but mostly I think we had a feeling of where, yeah, what direction we wanted to go, and certainly that trying to balance the communal and time and solitude were important to both of us, and maybe a bit more for me the solitude aspect in there. Not that I, but Ajahn Amaro certainly has an appreciation as well, and his time in England was was. That's a very kind of, especially those years now, it's quite different. His formative years in England, the kind of the community dynamics were very, very intense. And a lot of it was situations that they're in. I mean, that's one of the things that we were having, say, a big forest in California. We've got the space to everybody to have kutis. And the Gajahn Amaro, right off the bat, first coming here, your first, it's like everybody out in the forest. I mean, there was the house that we had, nobody ever spent the night there.
Mm-hmm. First few weeks.
First few weeks.
Yeah, before we got 10 sites.
Before you got 10 sites. Yeah, well, it's okay, but that's... you had to have the 10
sites.
Right.
Better get to
the 10 sites. Yeah, get to the 10. It's like that down there was just a real briar.
I was all blackberry bramble.
Yeah.
I mean, I was chomping away for, it seemed like, weeks.
Yeah, so, and people are already, you know, out, you know, fairly, like, Ajahn Vasutti was up at the, where the sauna is now? Is that where his tent site was?
I think his first tent site. Yeah, right, that's right, at the sauna, yeah. I'm sorry, I was thinking the one Kevin was in there.
So, you know, people were already, you know, that ethos was there, and just having forest, and then having a monastery that you actually built as a monastery. Ajahn Amaro was just over the moon to be able to do that, because it was, for me, it was sort of, well, it was kind of a given. But for him, he'd spent his whole vast majority of his monastic life trying to fit monastic life into existing buildings and structures that weren't monasteries, and then also not having the space. So both of us really. You know, saw the value in that balance of communal and solitude, and the opportunity to rely on the forest as a place of practice.
Yeah, I like to share the experience about that, about solitude. When we were jidhas, the women would pack together in one little cottage.
Yeah.
And the one thing that's wonderful is that if you serve the winter retreat for 3 months, then you have 12 days to go in the forest and stay at the kuti by yourself.
Yeah.
And first I thought, ooh, you know, kind of. But it was wonderful because everybody come back, they're just so happy. Smiling, everything. It was just wonderful. Because of the tight situation of living in a little cottage together, you know,
yeah.
So that's really helpful. But here, it's different.
Yeah.
Yes.